Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, by R.A. Salvatore. Based on the story by George Lucas, and the screenplay by George Lucas and Jonathan Hales. Read for you by Jonathan Davis. A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away. Prelude. His mind absorbed the scene before him, so quiet and calm and normal. It was the life he had always wanted, a gathering of family and friends. He knew that they were just that, though the only one he recognized was his dear mother. This was the way it was supposed to be. The warmth and the love, the laughter and the quiet times. This was how he had always dreamed it would be, how he had always prayed it would be. The warm, inviting smiles, the pleasant conversation, the gentle pats on shoulders. But most of all, there was the smile of his beloved mother, so happy now, no more a slave. When she looked at him, he saw all of that and more. Saw how proud she was of him, how joyful her life had become. She moved before him, her face beaming, her hand reaching out for him to gently stroke his face. Her smile brightened, then widened some more. Too much more. For a moment, he thought the exaggeration a product of love beyond normal bounds, but the smile continued to grow, his mother's face stretching and contorting weirdly. She seemed to be moving in slow motion then. They all did, slowing as if their limbs had become heavy. No, not heavy, he realized, his warm feelings turning suddenly hot. It was as if these friends and his mother were becoming rigid and stiff, as if they were becoming something less than living and breathing humans. He stared back at that caricature of a smile, the twisted face, and recognized the pain behind it. A crystalline agony. He tried to call out to her, to ask her what she needed him to do, ask her how he could help. Her face twisted even more, blood running from her eyes. Her skin crystallized, becoming almost translucent, almost like glass. Glass. She was glass. The light glistened off her crystalline highlights. The blood ran fast over her smooth surface. And her expression, a look of resignation and apology, a look that said she had failed him and that he had failed her, drove a sharp point straight into the helpless onlooker's heart. He tried to reach out for her, tried to save her. Cracks began to appear in the glass. He heard the crunching sounds as they elongated. He cried out repeatedly, reached for her desperately. Then he thought of the Force and sent his thoughts there with all his willpower, reaching for her with all his energy. But then, she shattered. The Jedi Padawan jumped to a sitting position in his cot on the starship, his eyes popping open wide, sweat on his forehead, and his breath coming in gasps. A dream. It was all a dream. He told himself that repeatedly as he tried to settle back down on the cot. It was all a dream. Or was it? He could see things after all before they happened. Ancien! Came a call from the front of the ship, the familiar voice of his master. He knew that he had to shake the dream away, had to focus on the events at hand, the latest assignment beside his master. But that was easier said than done. For he saw her again, his mother, her body going rigid, crystallizing, then exploding into a million shattered shards. He looked up ahead, envisioning his master at the controls, wondering if he should tell all to the Jedi, wondering if the Jedi would be able to help him. But that thought washed away as soon as it had crossed his mind. His master, Obi-Wan Kenobi, would not be able to help. They were too involved in other things, in his training, in minor assignments like the border dispute that had brought them so far out from Coruscant. The Padawan wanted to get back to Coruscant as soon as possible. He needed guidance now, but not the kind he was getting from Obi-Wan. He needed to speak with Chancellor Palpatine again, to hear the man's reassuring words. Palpatine had taken a great interest in him over the last 10 years, making sure that he always got a chance to speak with him whenever he and Obi-Wan were on Coruscant. The Padawan took great comfort in that now, with the terrible dream so vivid in his thoughts. For the Chancellor, the wise leader of all the Republic, had promised him that his powers would soar to previously unknown heights, that he would become a power even among the powerful Jedi. Perhaps that was the answer. Perhaps the mightiest of the Jedi, the mightiest of the mighty, could strengthen the fragile glass. "Ancien," came the call again from the front.
"Anakin, get up here."
Chapter 1 Shmi Skywalker Lars stood on the edge of the sand berm, marking the perimeter of the moisture farm, one leg up higher to the very top of the ridge, knee bent. With one hand on that knee for support, the middle-aged woman, her dark hair slightly graying, her face worn and tired, stared up at the many bright dots of starlight on this crisp Tatooine night. No sharp edges broke the landscape about her, just the smooth and rounded forms of wind-blown sand dunes on this planet of seemingly endless sands. Somewhere out in the distance, a creature groaned, a plaintive sound that resonated deeply within Shmi this night. This special night. Her son Anakin, her dearest little Annie, turned 20 this night, a birthday Shmi observed each year, though she hadn't seen her beloved child in a decade. How different he must be. How grown, how strong, how wise in the ways of the Jedi by now. Shmi, who had lived all of her life in a small area of drab Tatooine, knew that she could hardly imagine the wonders her boy might have found out there among the stars, on planets so different from this, with colors more vivid and water that filled entire valleys. A wistful smile widened on her still pretty face as she remembered those days long ago, when she and her son had been slaves of the wretch Watto. Annie, with his mischief and his dreams, with his independent attitude and unsurpassed courage, used to so infuriate the Toydarian junk dealer. Despite the hardships of life as a slave, there had been good times too back then. Despite their meager food, their meager possessions, despite the constant complaining and ordering about by Watto, she had been with Annie, her beloved Annie. "You should come in," came a quiet voice behind her. Shmi's smile only widened, and she turned to see her stepson, Owen Lars, walking over to join her. He was a stocky and strong boy about Anakin's age, with short brown hair, a few bristles, and a wide face that could not hide anything that was within his heart. Shmi tousled Owen's hair when he moved beside her, and he responded by draping an arm across her shoulders and kissing her on the cheek. "No starship tonight, Mom?" Owen asked good-naturedly. He knew why Shmi had come out here, why she came out here so very often in the quiet night. Shmi turned her hand over and gently stroked it down Owen's face, smiling. She loved this young man as she loved her own son, and he had been so good to her, so understanding of the hole that remained within her heart. Without jealousy, without judgment, Owen had accepted Shmi's pain and had always given her a shoulder to lean on. "No starship this night," she replied, and she looked back up at the starry canopy. "Anakin must be busy saving the galaxy or chasing smugglers and other outlaws. He has to do those things now, you know." "Then I shall sleep more soundly from this night forward," Owen replied with a grin. Though she was kidding, of course, Shmi did realize a bit of truth in her presumption about Anakin. He was a special child, something beyond the norm, even for a Jedi, she believed. Anakin had always stood taller than anyone else, not physically. Physically, as Shmi remembered him, he was just a smiling little boy with curious eyes and sandy blonde hair. But Annie could do things, and so very well. Even though he was only a child at the time, he had raced pods, defeating some of the very best racers on all of Tatooine. He was the first human ever to win one of the pod races, and that was when he was only 9 years old. And in a racer that Shmi remembered, with an even wider smile, had been built with spare parts taken from Watto's junkyard. But that was Anakin's very special way, because he was not like the other children, or even like other adults. Anakin could see things before they happened, as if he was so tuned to the world about him that he understood innately the logical conclusion to any course of events. He could often sense problems with his pod racer, for example, long before those problems manifested themselves in a catastrophic way. He had once told her that he could feel the upcoming obstacles in any course before he actually saw them. It was his special way, and that was why the Jedi who had come to Tatooine had recognized the unique nature of the boy and had freed him from Watto and taken him into their care and instruction. "I had to let him go," Shmi said quietly. "I could not keep him with me, if that meant living the life of a slave." "I know," Owen assured her. "I could not have kept him with me even if we were not slaves," she went on, and she looked at Owen as if her own words had surprised her. "Annie has so much to give to the galaxy. His gifts could not be contained by Tatooine. He belongs out there, flying across the stars, saving planets. He was born to be a Jedi, born to give so much more to so many more." "That is why I sleep better at night," Owen reiterated. And when Shmi looked at him, she saw that his grin was wider than ever. "Oh, you're teasing me," she said, reaching out to swat her stepson on the shoulder. Owen merely shrugged. Shmi's face went serious again. "Annie wanted to go," she went on, the same speech she had given Owen before, the same speech she had silently repeated to herself every night for the last 10 years. "His dream was to fly about the stars, to see every world in the whole galaxy, to do grand things. He was born a slave, but he was not born to be a slave. No, not my Annie. Not my Annie." Owen squeezed her shoulder. "You did the right thing. If I was Anakin, I would be grateful to you. I'd understand that you did what was best for me. There is no greater love than that, Mom." Shmi stroked his face again and even managed a wistful smile. "Come on in, Mom," Owen said, taking her hand. "It's dangerous out here." Shmi nodded and didn't resist at first as Owen started to pull her along. She stopped suddenly, though, and stared hard at her stepson as he turned back to regard her. "It's more dangerous out there," she said, sucking in her breath, her voice breaking. Alarm evident in her expression, she looked back up at the wide and open sky. "What if he is hurt, Owen? Or dead?" "It's better to die in pursuit of your dreams than to live a life without hope," Owen said, rather unconvincingly. Shmi looked back at him, her smile returning. Owen, like his father, was about as grounded in simple pragmatism as any man could be. She understood that he had said that only for her benefit, and that made it all the more special. She didn't resist anymore as Owen began to lead her along again, back to the humble abode of Cleeg Lars, her husband, Owen's father. She had done the right thing concerning her son, Shmi told herself with every step. They had been slaves, with no prospects of finding their freedom other than the offer of the Jedi. How could she have kept Anakin here on Tatooine when Jedi Knights were promising him all of his dreams? Of course, at that time, Shmi had not known that she would meet Cleeg Lars that fateful day in Mos Espa, and that the moisture farmer would fall in love with her, buy her from Watto, and free her, and only then, once she was a free woman, ask her to marry him. Would she have let Anakin go if she had known the changes that would come into her life so soon after his departure? Wouldn't her life be better now, more complete by far, if Anakin was beside her? Shmi smiled as she thought about it. No, she realized. She would still have wanted Annie to go, even if she had foreseen the dramatic changes that would soon come into her life. Not for herself, but for Anakin. His place was out there. She knew that. Shmi shook her head, overwhelmed by the enormity of it all, by the many winding turns in her life's path, in Anakin's path. Even in hindsight, she could not be sure that this present situation was not the best possible outcome for both of them. But still, there remained a deep and empty hole in her heart. Chapter 2. I can help with that, Beru said politely, moving to join Shmi, who was cooking dinner. Kleeg and Owen were out closing down the perimeter of the compound, securing the farm from the oncoming night, a night that promised a dust storm. Smiling warmly and glad that this young woman was soon to be a member of their family, Shmi handed a knife over to Beru. Owen hadn't said anything yet about marrying Beru, but Shmi could tell from the way the two looked at each other. It was only a matter of time, and not much time at that, if she knew her stepson. Owen was not an adventurous type, was as solid as the ground beneath them, but when he knew what he wanted, he went after it with single-minded purpose. Beru was exactly that, and she obviously loved Owen as deeply as he loved her. She was well-suited to be the wife of a moisture farmer, Shmi thought, watching her methodically go about her duties in the kitchen. She never shied from work, was very capable and diligent. And she doesn't expect much, or need much to make her happy, Shmi thought, for that, in truth, was the crux of it. Their existence here was simple and plain. There were few adventures, and none at all that were welcomed, for excitement out here usually meant that Tusken raiders had been seen in the region, or that a gigantic sandstorm or some other potentially devastating weather phenomenon was blowing up. The Lars family had only the simple things, mostly the company of each other, to keep them amused and content. For Kleeg, this had been the only way of life he had ever known, a lifestyle that went back several generations in the Lars family. Same thing for Owen. And while Beru had grown up in Mos Eisley, she seemed to fit right in. Yes, Owen would marry her, Shmi knew, and what a happy day that would be. The two men returned soon after, along with C-3PO, the protocol droid Anakin had built back in the days when he had Watto's junkyard to rummage through.
Two more tangaroots for you, Mistress Shmi, the thin droid said, handing Shmi a pair of orange and green freshly picked vegetables. I would have brought more, but I was told, and not in any civil way, that I must hurry.
Shmi looked to Kleeg, and he gave her a grin and a shrug.
Could have left him out there to get sandblasted clean, I suppose, he said. Of course, some of the bigger rocks that are sure to be flying about might have taken out a circuit or two.
Your pardon, Master Kleeg, 3PO said. I only meant...
We know what you meant, 3PO, Shmi assured the droid. She placed a comforting hand on his shoulder, then quickly pulled it away, thinking that a perfectly silly gesture to offer to a walking box of wires. Of course, C-3PO was much more than a box of wires to Shmi Skywalker Lars. Anakin had built the droid, almost. When Anakin had left with the Jedi, 3PO had been perfectly functional, but uncovered, his wire showing. Shmi had left him that way for a long time, fantasizing that Anakin would return to complete the job. Only after marrying Kleeg had Shmi finished the droid herself, adding the dull metal coverings. It had been quite a touching moment for Shmi, an admission of sorts that she was where she belonged, and Anakin was where he belonged. The protocol droid could be quite annoying at times, but to Shmi, C-3PO remained a reminder of her son.
Of course, if there are Tuskens about, they'd likely have gotten him under wraps before the storm.
Kleeg went on, obviously taking great pleasure in teasing the poor droid.
You're not afraid of Tusken Raiders, are you, 3PO?
There is nothing in my program to suggest such fear,
3PO replied, though he would have sounded more convincing if he hadn't been shaking as he spoke, and if his voice hadn't come out all squeaky and uneven.
Enough, Shmi demanded of Klieg.
Oh, poor 3PO, she said, patting the droid's shoulder again. Go ahead now. I've got more than enough help this evening. As she finished, she waved the droid away.
You're just terrible to that poor droid, she remarked,
moving beside her husband and playfully patting him across his broad shoulder.
Well, if I can't have fun with him, I'll have to set my sights on someone else, the rarely mischievous Klieg replied, narrowing his eyes and scanning the room.
He finally settled a threatening gaze on Beru.
Klieg, Shmi was quick to warn.
What? He protested dramatically. If she's thinking to come out and live here, then she had better learn to defend herself.
Dad? Owen cried.
Oh, don't fret about old Klieg, Beru piped in, emphasizing the word old. A fine wife I would make if I couldn't out-duel that one in a war of words.
Aha! A challenge, Klieg roared.
Not so much of one from where I'm sitting, Beru dryly returned. And she and Klieg began exchanging some good-natured insults, with Owen chiming in every now and again. Shmi hardly listened, too engaged in merely watching Beru. Yes, she would certainly fit in and well about the moisture farm. Her temperament was perfect, solid, but playful when the situation allowed. Gruff Klieg could verbally spar with the best of them, but Beru had to be counted among that elite lot. Shmi went back to her dinner preparations, her smile growing wider every time Beru hit Klieg with a particularly nasty retort. Intent on her work, Shmi never saw the missile coming, and when the overripe vegetable hit her on the side of the face, she let out a shriek. Of course, that only made the other three in the room howl with laughter. Shmi turned to see them sitting there, staring at her. From the embarrassed expression on Beru's face, and from the angle with Beru sitting directly behind Klieg, it seemed obvious to Shmi that Beru had launched the missile aiming for Klieg but throwing a bit high.
The girl listens when you tell her to stop, Klieg Lars said,
his sarcastic tone shattered by a burst of laughter that came right from his belly. He stopped when Shmi smacked him with a piece of juicy fruit, splattering it across his shoulders. A food fight began, measured, of course, and with more threats hurled than actual missiles. When it ended, Shmi began the cleanup, the other three helping for a bit. You two go and spend some time together without your troublemaking father, Shmi told Owen and Beru.
Klieg started it, so Klieg will help clean it up. Go on now. I'll call you back when dinner's on the table.
Klieg gave a little laugh. And if you mess up the next one, you're going to be hungry, Shmi told him, threateningly waving a spoon his way. And lonely.
Whoa, never that,
Klieg said, holding his hands up in a sign of surrender. With a wave of the spoon, Shmi further dismissed Owen and Beru, and the two went off happily.
She'll make him a fine wife, Shmi said to Klieg.
He walked up beside her and grabbed her about the waist, pulling her tight.
We Lars men fall in love with the best women.
Shmi looked back to see his warm and sincere smile, and she returned it in kind. This was the way it was supposed to be. Good, honest work, a sense of true accomplishment, and enough free time for some fun, at least. This was the life Shmi had always wanted. This was perfect. Almost. A wistful look came over her face.
Thinking of your boy again, Klieg Lars stated, instead of asked.
Shmi looked at him, her expression a mixture of joy and sadness, a single dark cloud crossing a sunny blue sky.
Yes, but it's okay this time, she said. He's safe, I know, and doing great things.
But when we have such fun, you wish he could be here.
Shmi smiled again.
I do, and in all other times as well. I wish Anakin had been here from the beginning, since you and I first met.
5 years ago, Klieg remarked.
He would love you as I do, and he and Owen.
Her voice weakened and trailed away. You think that Anakin and Owen would be friends? Klieg asked. Wow, of course they would.
You've never even met my Annie, Shmi scolded.
They'd be the best of friends, Klieg assured her, tightening his hug once again. How could they not be, with you as that one's mother?
Shmi accepted the compliment gracefully, looked back and gave Klieg a deep and appreciative kiss. She was thinking of Owen, of the young man's flowering romance with the lovely Beru. How Shmi loved them both. But that thought brought with it some level of discomfort. Shmi had often wondered if Owen had been part of the reason she had so readily agreed to marry Klieg. She looked back at her husband, rubbing her hand over his broad shoulder. Yes, she loved him, and deeply, and she certainly couldn't deny her joy at finally being relieved of her slave bonds. But despite all of that, what part had the presence of Owen played in her decisions? It had been a question that had stayed with her all these years. Had there been a need in her heart that Owen had filled? A mother's need to cover the hole left by Anakin's departure. In truth, the two boys were very different in temperament. Owen was solid and staid, the rock who would gladly take over the farm from Klieg when the time came, as this moisture farm had been passed down in the Lars family from generation to generation. Owen was ready, and even thrilled to be the logical and rightful heir to the place, more than able to accept the often difficult lifestyle in exchange for the pride and sense of honest accomplishment that came with running the place correctly. But Annie... Shmi nearly laughed aloud as she considered her impetuous and wanderlust-filled son put in a similar situation. She had no doubts that Anakin would give Klieg the same fits he had always given Watto. Anakin's adventurous spirit would not be tamed by any sense of generational responsibility, Shmi knew. His need to leap out for adventure, to race the pods, to fly among the stars, would not have been diminished, and it surely would have driven Klieg crazy. Now Shmi did giggle, picturing Klieg turning red-faced with exasperation when Anakin had let his duties slide once again. Klieg hugged her all the tighter at the sound, obviously having no clue of the mental images fluttering through her brain. Shmi melted into that hug, knowing that she was where she belonged, and taking comfort in the hope that Anakin, too, was where he truly belonged. She wasn't wearing one of the grand gowns that had marked the station of her life for the last decade and more. Her hair was not done up in wondrous fashion, with some glittering accessory woven into the thick brown strands. And in that plainness, Padme Amidala only appeared more beautiful and more shining. The woman sitting beside her on the bench swing, so obviously a relation, was a bit older, a bit more matronly, perhaps, with clothes even more plain than Padme's, and with her hair a bit more out of place. But she was no less beautiful, shining with an inner glow equally strong. "Did you finish your meetings with Queen Jamila?" Sola asked. It was obvious from her tone that the meetings to which she had referred were not high on her personal wish list. Padme looked over at her, then looked back to the playhouse, where Sola's daughters, Ryu and Pooja, were in the midst of a wild game of tag. "It was one meeting," Padme explained. "The Queen had some information to pass along." "About the Military Creation Act," Sola stated. Padme didn't bother to confirm the obvious. The Military Creation Act, now before the Senate, was the most important piece of business in many years. One that held implications for the Republic even beyond those during the dark time when Padme had been queen and the Trade Federation had tried to conquer Naboo. "The Republic is all in a tumult, but not to fear, for Senator Amidala will put it all aright," Sola said. Padme turned to her, somewhat surprised by the level of sarcasm in Sola's tone. "That's what you do, right?" Sola innocently asked. "It's what I try to do." "It's all you try to do." "What is that supposed to mean?" Padme asked, her face twisting with puzzlement. I am a senator after all. A senator after a queen and probably with many more offices ahead of her, Sola said. She looked back at the playhouse and called for Ryu and Pooja to ease up.
You speak as if it's a bad thing, Padme remarked.
Sola looked at her earnestly.
It's a great thing, she said,
if you're doing it all for the right reasons.
And what is that supposed to mean?
Sola shrugged, as if she wasn't quite sure.
I think you've convinced yourself that you're indispensable to the Republic, she said,
that they couldn't get along at all without you.
Sis!
It's true, Sola insisted.
You give and give and give and give. Don't you ever want to take just a little?
Padme's smile showed that Sola's words had caught her off guard.
Take what?
Sola looked back at Ryu and Pooja.
Look at them.
I see the sparkle in your eyes when you watch my children. I know how much you love them.
Of course I do.
Wouldn't you like to have children of your own? Sola asked. A family of your own? Padme sat up straight, her eyes going wide.
She started and stopped several times. I'm working right now for something I deeply believe in, for something that's important.
And after this is settled, after the Military Creation Act is far behind you, you'll find something else to deeply believe in, something else that's really important. Something that concerns the Republic and the government more than it really concerns you.
How can you say that?
Because it's true, and you know it's true. When are you going to do something just for yourself?
I am.
You know what I mean. Padme gave a little laugh and a shake of her head and turned back to Ryu and Pooja.
Is everyone to be defined by their children? She asked.
Of course not, Sola replied.
It's not that at all.
Or not just that.
I'm talking about something bigger, sis.
You spend all your time worrying about the problems of other people, of this planet's dispute with that planet, or whether this trade guild is acting fairly toward that system. All of your energy is being thrown out there to try to make the lives of everyone else better.
What's wrong with that?
What about your life? Sola asked in all seriousness. What about Padme Amidala? Have you even thought about what might make your life better? Most people who have been in public service as long as you have would have retired by now. I know you get satisfaction in helping other people. That's pretty obvious. But what about something deeper for you? What about love, sis? And yes, what about having kids? Have you even thought about it? Have you even wondered what it might be like for you to settle down and concern yourself with those things that will make your own life fuller? Padme wanted to retort that her life didn't need to be any fuller. But she found herself holding back the words. Somehow, they seemed hollow to her at that particular moment. Watching her nieces romping about the backyard of the house, now jumping all about poor R2-D2, Padme's astromech droid. For the first time in many days, Padme's thoughts roamed free of her responsibilities, free of the important vote she would have to cast in the Senate in less than a month. Somehow, the words Military Creation Act couldn't filter through the whimsical song that Ryu and Pooja were then making up about R2-D2.
Too close, Owen remarked gravely to Klieg, the two of them walking the perimeter of the moisture farm, checking the security.
The call of a bantha, the large and shaggy beasts often ridden by Tuscans, had interrupted their conversation. They both knew it was unlikely that a bantha would be roaming wild about this region, for there was little grazing area anywhere near the desolate moisture farm. But they had heard the call, and could identify it without doubt, and they suspected that potential enemies were near.
"What is driving them so close to the farms?" Owen asked.
"It has been too long since we've organized anything against them," Klieg replied gruffly. "We let the beasts run free, and they're forgetting the lessons we taught them in the past."
He looked hard at Owen's skeptical expression.
"You have to go out there and teach the Tuscans their manners every now and again."
Owen just stood there, having no response.
See how long it's been, Cleek said with a snort. You don't even remember the last time we went out and chased off the Tuscans. There's the problem right there.
The bantha lowed again. Cleek gave a growl in the general direction of the sound, waved his hand, and walked off toward the house.
You keep Baru close for a bit, he instructed. The both of you, stay within the perimeter, and keep a blaster at your side.
Owen nodded, and dutifully followed as Cleek stalked into the house. Right before the pair reached the door, the bantha lowed again. It didn't seem so far away.
What's the matter? Shmi asked the moment Cleek entered the house.
Her husband stopped and managed to paste on a bit of a comforting smile.
Just the sand, he said. Covered some sensors, and I'm getting a bit tired of digging them out.
He smiled even wider and walked to the side of the room, heading for the refresher.
Cleek,
Shmi called suspiciously, stopping him. Owen came through the door then, and Baru looked at him.
What is it?
She asked, unconsciously echoing Shmi.
Nothing, nothing at all, Owen replied.
But as he crossed the room, Baru stepped before him and took him by the arms, forcing him to look at her directly, into an expression too serious to be dismissed.
Just signs of a sandstorm, Cleek lied. Far off and probably nothing.
But already enough to bury some sensors on the perimeter? Shmi asked.
Owen looked at her curiously, then heard Cleek clear his throat. He looked to his father, who nodded slightly, then turned back to Shmi and agreed.
The first wins, but I don't think it will be as strong as father believes.
Are you both going to stand there lying to us?
Baru snapped suddenly, stealing the words from Shmi's mouth.
What did you see, Cleek? Shmi demanded.
Nothing, he answered with conviction.
Then what did you hear?
Shmi pressed, recognizing her husband's semantic dodge clearly enough.
I heard a bantha, nothing more, Cleek admitted.
And you think it was a Tuscan mount, Shmi stated.
How far?
Who can tell in the night, and with the wind shifting? Could have been kilometers.
Or?
Cleek walked back across the room to stand right before his wife.
What do you want from me, love? He asked, taking her in a firm hug. I heard a bantha. I don't know if there was a Tuscan attached.
But there has been more signs of the raiders about, Owen admitted. The doors found a pile of bantha poodoo half covering one of their perimeter sensors.
It may be just that there's a few banthas running loose in the area, probably half starved and looking for some food, Cleek offered.
Or it might be that the Tuscans are growing bolder, are coming right down to the edges of the farms, and are even beginning to test the security, Shmi said.
Almost prophetically, just as she finished, the alarms went off, indicating a breach about the perimeter sensor line. Owen and Cleek grabbed their blaster rifles and rushed out of the house, Shmi and Baru close behind.
You stay here,
Cleek instructed the two women.
Or go get a weapon, at least.
He glanced about, indicated a vantage point to Owen, and motioned for his son to take up a defensive position and cover him. Then he rushed across the compound, blaster rifle in hand, zigzagging his way, staying low and scanning for any movement, knowing that if he saw a form that resembled either Tuscan or Bantha, he'd shoot first and investigate after. But it didn't come to that. Cleek and Owen searched the whole of the perimeter, scanned the area and rechecked the alarms, and found no sign of intruders. All four stayed on edge the remainder of that night, though, each of them keeping a weapon close at hand and sleeping only in shifts. The next day, out by the eastern rim, Owen found the source of the alarm. A footprint along a patch of sturdier ground near the edge of the farm. It wasn't the large round depression a bantha would make, but the indentation one might expect from a foot wrapped in soft material, much like a Tuscan would wear.
We should speak with the doors and all the others, Cleek said when Owen showed the print to him. Get a group together and chase the animals back into the open desert.
The banthas?
Them too, Cleek snarled.
He spat upon the ground, as steely-eyed and angry as Owen had ever seen him.
Senator Padme Amidala felt strangely uneasy in her office, in the same complex as, but unattached to, the royal palace of Queen Jamila. Her desk was covered in holodisks and all the other usual clutter of her station. At the front of it, a holo played through the numbers. A soldier on one scale, a flag of truce on the other, tallying the predicted votes for the meeting on Coruscant. The hologram depiction of those scales seemed almost perfectly balanced. Padme knew that the vote would be close, with the Senate almost evenly divided over whether the Republic should create a formal army. It galled her to think that so many of her colleagues would be voting based on personal gain. Everything from potential contracts to supply the army for their home systems to direct payoffs from some of the defecting separatist systems, rather than on what was best for the Republic. In her heart, Padme remained steadfast that she had to work to defeat the creation of this army. The Republic was built on tolerance. It was a vast network of tens of thousands of systems, and even more species, each with a distinct perspective. The only element they shared was tolerance. Tolerance of one another. The creation of an army might prove unsettling, even threatening to so many of those systems and species, beings far removed from the great city planet of Coruscant. A commotion outside drew Padme to the window, and she looked down upon the complex courtyard to see a group of men jostling and fighting as the Naboo security forces rushed in to control the situation. There came a sharp rap on the door to her office, and as she turned back that way, the portal slid open, and Captain Panaka strode in. "Just checking, Senator," said the man who had served as her personal bodyguard when she was queen. Tall and dark-skinned, he had a steely gaze and an athletic physique only accentuated by the cut of his brown leather jerkin, blue shirt, and pants. And the mere sight of Panaka filled Padme with comfort. He was in his 40s now, but still looked as if he could outfight any man on Naboo. "Shouldn't you be seeing to the security of Queen Jamila?" Padme asked.
Panaka nodded. "She is well protected, I assure you."
"From?" Padme prompted,
nodding toward the window and the continuing disturbance beyond. "Spice miners," Panaka explained. "Contract issues. Nothing to concern you, Senator. Actually, I was on my way here to speak with you about security for your return trip to Coruscant."
"That is weeks away."
Panaka looked to the window. "Which gives us more time to properly prepare." Padme knew better than to argue with the stubborn man. Since she would be flying an official starship of the Naboo fleet, Panaka had the right, if not the responsibility, to get involved. And in truth, his concern pleased her, although she'd never admit it to him. A shout outside and renewed fighting drew her attention briefly, making her wince. Another problem. There was always a problem somewhere. Padme had to wonder if that was just the nature of people, to create some excitement when all seemed well. Given that unsettling thought, Sola's words came back to her, along with images of Ryu and Pooja. How she loved those two carefree little sprites.
"Senator," Panaka said, drawing her out of her private contemplations.
"Yes."
"We should discuss the security procedures."
It pained Padme to let go of the images of her nieces at that moment, but she nodded and forced herself back into her responsible mode. Captain Panaka had said that they had to discuss security, and so Padme Amidala had to discuss security. The Lars family was being serenaded through yet another night by the lowing of many banthas. None of the four had any doubt that Tuscans were out there, not far from the farm. Perhaps, even then, watching its lights.
"They're wild beasts, and we should have gotten the Mos Eisley authorities to exterminate them like the vermin they are. Them and the stinking Jawas."
Shmi sighed and put her hand on her husband's tense forearm. "The Jawas have helped us," she reminded him gently.
"Then not the Jawas," Klieg roared back, and Shmi jumped.
Taking note of Shmi's horrified expression, Klieg calmed at once.
"I'm sorry. Not the Jawas, then. But the Tuscans. They kill and steal whenever and wherever they can. No good comes of them.
If they try to come in here, there'll be less of them to chase back out into the desert, Owen offered, and Klee gave him an appreciative nod. They tried to finish their dinner, but every time a bantha sounded, they all tensed, hands shifting from utensils to readied blasters.
Listen, Shmi said suddenly, and they all went perfectly quiet, straining their ears. All was quiet outside. No banthas were lowing.
Perhaps they were just moving by, Shmi offered, when she was certain the others had caught on.
Heading back out into the open desert where they belong.
We'll go out to the doors in the morning, Klieg said to Owen. We'll get all the farmers organized, and maybe get a call in to Mos Eisley as well.
He looked at Shmi and nodded.
Just to make sure. In the morning, Owen agreed.
At dawn the next day, Owen and Klieg started out from the compound before they had even eaten a good breakfast, for Shmi had gone out ahead of them, as she did most mornings, to pick some mushrooms at the vaporators. They expected to pass her on their way out to the Doors farm, but instead found her footprints, surrounded by the imprints of many others.
The soft boots of the Tuskens.
Klieg Lars, as strong and tough a man as the region had ever known, fell to his knees and wept.
We have to go after her, Dad,
came a suddenly solid and unwavering voice. Klieg looked up and back to see Owen standing there, a man indeed and no more a boy, his expression grim and determined.
She is alive, and we cannot leave her to them, Owen said, with a strange, almost supernatural calm.
Klieg wiped away the last of his tears and stared hard at his son, then nodded grimly.
Spread the word to the neighboring farms.
Chapter 3.
There they are!
Shoal Dorr cried, pointing straight ahead while keeping his speeder bike at full throttle. The 29 others saw the target, the rising dust of a line of walking banthas. With a communal roar, the outraged farmers pressed on, determined to exact revenge, determined to rescue Shmi Skywalker, if she was still alive among this band of Tusken raiders. Amidst the roar of engines and cries of revenge, they swept down the descending wash, closing fast on the banthas, eager for battle. Klieg pumped his head, growling all the while, as if pleading with his bike to speed up. He swerved in from the left flank, cutting into the center of the formation, then lowered his head and opened the bike up to full speed, trying to catch the lead riders. All he wanted was to be in the thick of it, to get his strong arms about a Tusken throat. The banthas were clearly in sight then, along with their rope riders. Another cry went up, one of revenge, but one that fast turned to horror. The leading edge of the farmer army plowed headlong into a wire, cleverly strung across the field at neck height to a man riding a speeder bike. Klieg's own cry also became one of horror as he watched the decapitation of several of his friends and neighbors, as he watched others thrown to the ground from their bikes. Purely on instinct, knowing he couldn't stop his bike in time, Klieg leapt up, planting one foot on the seat of his bike, then leapt again. And then he felt a flash of pain, and he was spinning head over heels. He landed hard on the rocky ground, skidding briefly. All the world about him became a blur, a frenzy of sudden activity. He saw the boots of his fellow farmers, heard Owen crying out to him, though it seemed as if his son's voice was far, far away. He saw the wrapped leather of a Tuscan boot, the sand-colored robes, and with a rage that could not be denied by his disorientation, Klee grabbed that leg as the Tuscan ran past. He looked up and raised his arms to block as the Tuscan brought its staff slamming down at him. Accepting the pain, not even feeling it through his rage, Klieg shoved forward and wrapped both his arms around the Tuscan's legs, tugging the creature down to the ground before him. He crawled over it, his strong hands battering it, then finding the hold he wanted. Cries of pain from farmers and Tuscans alike were all about him, but Klieg hardly heard them. His hands remained firmly about the Tuscan's throat. He choked with all his considerable strength. He lifted the Tuscan's head up and bashed it back down over and over again and continued to choke and to batter long after the Tuscan stopped resisting.
Dad!
That cry alone brought Klieg from his rage. He dropped the Tuscan raider back to the ground and turned about to see Owen in close battle with another of the raiders. Klieg spun about and started to rise, putting one leg under him, coming up fast. And then he fell hard, his balance inexplicably gone. Confused, he looked down, expecting that another Tuscan had tripped him up. But then he saw that it was his own body that had failed him. Only then did Klieg Lars realize that he had lost his leg. Blood pooled all about the ground, pouring freely from the severed limb. Eyes wide with horror, Klieg grabbed at his leg. He called for Owen. He called desperately for Shmi. A speeder bike whipped past him, a farmer fleeing the massacre, but the man did not slow. Klieg tried to call out, but there was no voice to be found past the lump in his throat, the realization that he had failed and that all was lost. Then a second bike came by him, this one stopping fast. Reflexively, Klieg grabbed at it, and before he could even begin to pull himself up at all, the bike sped away, dragging him along.
"Hold on, Dad!"
Owen, the driver, cried to him. And Klieg did. With the same stubbornness that had sustained him through all the difficult times at the moisture farm, the same gritty determination that had allowed him to conquer the harsh wild land of Tatooine, Klieg Lars held on. For all his life, and with Tuscans in fast pursuit, Klieg Lars held on. And for Shmi, for the only chance she had of any rescue, Klieg Lars held on. Back up the slope, Owen stopped the bike and leapt off, grabbing at his father's torn leg. He tied it off as well as he could with the few moments he had, then helped Klieg, who was fast slipping from consciousness, to lie over the back of the bike. Then Owen sped away, throttle flat out. He knew that he had to get his father home, and quickly. The vicious wound had to be cleaned and sealed. It occurred to Owen that only a single pair of speeders were to be seen fleeing the massacre ahead of him, and that through all the commotion behind, he didn't hear the hum of a single speeder engine. Forcing despair away, finding the same grounded determination that sustained Klieg, Owen didn't think of the many lost friends, didn't think of his father's plight, didn't think of anything except the course to his necessary destination.
"This is not good news," Captain Panaka remarked, after delivering the blow to Senator Amidala. "We've suspected all along that Count Dooku and the Separatists would court the Trade Federation and the various commercial guilds," Padme replied, trying to put a good face on it all. Panaka had just come in with Captain Typho, his nephew, with the report that the Trade Federation had thrown in with the Separatist movement that now threatened to tear the Republic apart. "Viceroy Gunray is an opportunist," she continued. "He will do anything that he believes will benefit him financially. His loyalties end at his purse. Count Dooku must be offering him favorable trade agreements, free run to produce goods without regard to the conditions of the workers or the effect on the environment. Viceroy Gunray has left more than one planet as a barren dead ball floating in space. Or perhaps Count Dooku is offering the Trade Federation absolute control of lucrative markets without competition." "I'm more concerned with the implications to you, Senator," Panaka remarked, drawing a curious stare from Padme. "The Separatists have shown themselves not to be above violence," he explained. "There have been assassination attempts across the Republic." "But wouldn't Count Dooku and the Separatists consider Senator Amidala almost an ally at this time?" Captain Typho interjected. And both Panaka and Padme looked at the usually quiet man in surprise. Padme's look quickly turned into a stare. There was an angry edge to her fair features. "I am no friend to any who would dissolve the Republic, Captain," she insisted, her tone leaving no room for debate. And of course, there would be no debating that point. In the few years she had been a senator,
Amidala had shown herself to be among the most loyal and powerful supporters of the Republic, a legislator determined to improve the system, but to do so within the framework of the Republic Constitution. Senator Amidala fervently believed that the real beauty of the governing system was its built-in abilities, even demands for self-improvement.
"Agreed, Senator," Typho said with a bow. He was shorter than his uncle, but powerfully built, muscles filling the blue sleeves of his uniform, his chest solid under the brown leather tunic. He wore a black leather patch over his left eye, which he had lost in the battle with that same Trade Federation a decade before. Typho had been just a teenager then, but he had shown himself well and made his uncle Panaka proud. And no offense meant, but on this issue concerning the creation of an army of the Republic, you have remained firmly in the court of negotiation over force. Would not the separatists agree with your vote?
When Padme put her initial outrage aside and considered the point, she had to agree.
"Count Dooku has thrown in with Newt Gunray, say the reports," Panaka cut in, his tone flat and determined. "That mere fact demands that we tighten security about Senator Amidala."
"Please do not speak about me as though I am not here," she scolded. But Panaka didn't blink.
"In matters of security, Senator, you are not here," he replied. "At least your voice is not. My nephew reports to me, and his responsibilities on this matter cannot be undermined. Take all precautions."
With that, he bowed curtly and walked away, and Padme suppressed her immediate desire to rebuke him. He was right, and she was better off because he dared to point it out. She looked back at Captain Typho.
"We will be vigilant, Senator.
I have my duty, and that duty demands that I soon return to Coruscant," she said.
"And I have my duty," Typho assured her.
And like Panaka, he offered a bow and walked away. Padme Amidala watched him go, then gave a great sigh, remembering Sola's words to her and wondering honestly if she would ever find the opportunity to follow her sister's advice. Advice that she was finding strangely tempting at that particular moment. She realized then that she hadn't seen Sola, or the kids, or her parents in nearly 2 weeks, not since that afternoon in the backyard with Ryu and Pooja. Time did seem to be slipping past her.
"It won't move fast enough to catch up to the Tuscans," Kleeg Lars bellowed in protest as his son and future daughter-in-law helped him into a hover chair that Owen had fashioned. He seemed oblivious to the pain of his wound, where his right leg had been sheared off at mid-thigh.
"The Tuscans are long gone, Dad," Owen Lars said quietly, and he put his hand on Kleeg's broad shoulder, trying to calm him. "If you won't use a mechno leg, this power chair will have to do."
"You'll not be making me into a half-droid, that's for sure," Kleeg retorted. "This little buggy will do fine." "We'll get more men together," he said, his voice rising frantically, his hand instinctively moving down to the stump of his leg. "You get to Mos Eisley and see what support they'll offer. Send Beru to the farms."
"They've no more to offer," Owen replied honestly. He moved close to the chair and bent low, looking Kleeg square in the face. "All the farms will be years in recovering from the ambush. So many families have been shattered from the attack, and even more from the rescue attempt."
"How can you talk like that with your mother out there?"
Kleeg Lars roared, his frustration boiling over, and all the more so because in his heart, he knew that Owen was speaking truthfully. Owen took a deep breath, but did not back down from that imposing look. "We have to be realistic, Dad. It's been 2 weeks since they took her," he said grimly, leaving the implications unspoken. Implications that Kleeg Lars, who knew the dreaded Tuscans well, surely understood. All of a sudden, Kleeg's broad shoulders slumped in defeat, and his fiery gaze softened as his eyes turned toward the ground.
"She's gone," the wounded man whispered. "Really gone."
Behind him, Beru White Sun started to cry. Beside him, Owen fought back his own tears, knowing that he had to be the rock here, the firm foundation upon which a devastated Klieg and heartbroken Beru could stand. Chapter 4. The four starships skimmed past the great skyscrapers of Coruscant, weaving in and out of the huge amber structures, artificial stalagmites rising higher and higher over the years, and now obscuring the natural formations of the planet, unlike anywhere else in the known galaxy. Sunlight reflected off the many mirror-like windows of those massive structures and gleamed brilliantly off the chrome of the sleek ships. The larger silvery starship, which resembled the flying silver boomerang, almost glowed, smooth and flowing, with huge and powerful engines set on each of its arms, a third of the way to the wingtip. Alongside it soared the Naboo starfighters, their graceful engines set out on wings from the main hulls with their distinctive elongated tails. One of the starfighters led the procession, veering around and about nearly every passing tower, running point for the second ship, the Naboo Royal Cruiser. Behind that larger craft came two more fighters, running swift and close to the royal yacht, shielding her, pilots ready to instantly intercept any threat. The lead fighter avoided the more heavily trafficked routes of the great city, where potential enemies might be flying within the cover of thousands of ordinary vehicles. Many knew that Senator Padme Amidala of Naboo was returning to the Senate to cast her vote against the creation of an army to assist the overwhelmed Jedi in their dealings with the increasingly antagonistic separatist movement, and there were many factions that did not want such a vote to be cast. Amidala had made many enemies during her reign as Naboo's queen, powerful enemies with great resources at their disposal, and with perhaps enough hatred for the beautiful young senator of Naboo to put some of those resources to work to her detriment. In the lead fighter, Corporal Dolphy, who had distinguished himself greatly in the Naboo War against the Trade Federation, breathed a sigh of relief as the appointed landing platform came into sight, appearing secure and clear. Dolphy, a tough warrior who revered his senator greatly, flew past the landing platform to the left, then cut a tight turn back to the right, encircling the great structure, the senatorial apartment building, adjacent to the landing platform. He kept his fighter up and about as the other two fighters put down side by side on one end of the platform, the Royal Cruiser hovering nearby for just a moment, then gently landing. Dolphy did another circuit, then, seeing no traffic at all in the vicinity, settled his fighter across the way from his companion craft. He didn't put it down all the way just yet, though, but remained ready to swivel about and strike hard at any attackers, if need be. Opposite him, the other two fighter pilots threw back their respective canopies and climbed from their cockpits. One, Captain Typho, recently appointed as Amidala's chief security officer by his uncle Panaka, pulled off his flight helmet and shook his head, running a hand over his short, woolly black hair and adjusting the black leather patch he wore over his left eye. "We made it," Typho said, as his fellow fighter pilot leapt down from a wing to stand beside him. "I guess I was wrong. There was no danger at all." "There's always danger, Captain," the other responded in a distinctly female voice. "Sometimes we're just lucky enough to avoid it." Typho started to respond, but paused and looked back toward the cruiser, where the ramp was already lowering to the platform. The plan had been to get the contingent off the exposed platform and into a transport vehicle as quickly as possible. Two Naboo guards appeared, alert and ready, their blaster rifles presented before them. Typho nodded grimly, glad to see that his soldiers were taking nothing for granted, that they understood the gravity of the situation and the responsibility here in protecting the senator. Next came Amidala, in her typical splendor, with her paradoxical beauty, both simple and involved. With her large brown eyes and soft features, Amidala could outshine anyone about her, even if she was dressed in simple peasant's clothing. But in her senatorial attire, this time a fabulous weave of black and white, and with her hair tied up and exaggerated by a black headdress, she outshone the stars themselves. Her mixture of intelligence and beauty, of innocence and allure, of courage and integrity, and yet with a good measure of a child's mischievousness,
floored Typho every time he looked upon her. The captain turned from the descending entourage back to Dolphy across the way, offering a satisfied nod in acknowledgement of the man's point-running work. And then, suddenly, Typho was lying face down on the permacrete, thrown to the ground by a tremendous concussion, blinded for a moment by a brilliant flash as an explosion roared behind him. He looked up as his vision returned to see Dolphy sprawled on the ground. Everything seemed to move in slow motion for Typho at that terrible moment. He heard himself yelling, "No!" as he scrambled up to his feet and turned about. Pieces of burning metal spread through the Coruscant sky like fireworks, fanning high and wide from the wreckage. The remaining hulk of the Royal Cruiser burned brightly, and seven figures lay on the ground before it. One, wearing the decorated raiments that Typho knew so very well. Disoriented from the blast, the captain stumbled as he tried to rise. A great lump welled in his throat, for he knew what had happened. Typho was a veteran warrior, had seen battle, had seen people die violently. And in looking at those bodies, in looking at Amidala's beautiful robes, at their placement about the very still form, he instinctively knew. The woman's wounds were surely mortal. She was fast dying, if not already dead.
"You reset the coordinates," Obi-Wan Kenobi said to his young Padawan. Obi-Wan's wheat-colored hair was longer now, hanging loosely about his shoulders, and a beard, somewhat unkempt, adorned his still young-looking face. His light brown Jedi traveling clothes, loose-fitting and comfortable, seemed to settle on him well. For Obi-Wan had become comfortable, had grown into the skin of a Jedi Knight. No longer was he the intense and impulsive Jedi Padawan learner under the training of Qui-Gon Jinn. His companion at this time, however, appeared quite the opposite. Anakin Skywalker looked as if his tall, thin frame simply could not contain his overabundance of energy. He was dressed similarly to Obi-Wan, but his clothing seemed tighter, crisper, and his muscles under it always seemed taut with readiness. His sandy blonde hair was cropped short now, except for the thin braid indicative of his status as a Jedi Padawan. His blue eyes flashed repeatedly, as if bursts of energy were escaping. "Just to lengthen our time in hyperspace a bit," he explained. "We'll come out closer to the planet." Obi-Wan gave a great and resigned sigh and sat down at the console, noting the coordinates Anakin had input. There was little the Jedi could do about it now, of course, for a hyperspace leap couldn't be reset once the jump to lightspeed had already been made. "We cannot exit hyperspace too close to the Coruscant approach lanes. There's too much congestion for a safe flight. I've already explained this to you." "But, Anakin," Obi-Wan said pointedly, as if he were scolding a pet Perutu cat. And he tightened his wide jaw and stared hard at his Padawan.
"Yes, Master," Anakin said, obediently looking down.
Obi-Wan held the glare for just a moment longer. "I know that you're anxious to get there," he conceded. "We have been too long away from home."
Anakin didn't look up, but Obi-Wan could see the edges of his lips curl up in a bit of a smile.
"Never do this again," Obi-Wan warned, and he turned and walked out of the shuttle's bridge.
Anakin flopped down into the pilot's chair, his chin falling into his hand, his eyes set on the control panels. The order had been about as direct as one could get, of course, and so Anakin silently told himself that he would adhere to it. Still, as he considered their current destination, and who awaited them there, he thought the scolding worth it. Even if his resetting of the coordinates had bought him only a few extra hours on Coruscant. He was indeed anxious to get there, though not for the reason Obi-Wan had stated. It wasn't the Jedi Temple that beckoned to the Padawan, but rather a rumor he had heard over the comm chatter that a certain senator, formerly the Queen of Naboo, was on her way to address the Senate. Padme Amidala. The name resonated in young Anakin's heart and soul. He hadn't seen her in a decade, not since he, along with Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon, had helped her in her struggle against the Trade Federation on Naboo. He had only been 10 years old at that time, but from the moment he had first laid eyes on Padme, young Anakin had known that she was the woman he would marry. Never mind that Padme was several years older than him. Never mind that he was just a boy when he had known her, when she had known him. Never mind that Jedi were not allowed to marry. Anakin had simply known, without question, and the image of beautiful Padme Amidala had stayed with him, had been burned into his every dream and fantasy, every day since he had left Naboo with Obi-Wan a decade ago. He could still smell the freshness of her hair, could still see the sparkle of intelligence and passion in her wondrous brown eyes, could still hear the melody that was Padme's voice. Hardly registering the movement, Anakin let his hands return to the controls of the nav computer. Perhaps he could find a little used lane through the Coruscant traffic congestion to get them home faster. Klaxons blared and myriad alarms rent the air all about the area, screaming loudly, drowning out the cries from the astonished onlookers and the wails of the injured. Typho's companion pilot raced past him, and the captain scrambled to regain his footing and follow. Across the way, Dolphy was up and similarly running toward the fallen form of the senator. The female fighter pilot arrived first, dropping to one knee beside the fallen woman. She pulled the helmet from her head and quickly shook her brown tresses free. "Senator!" Typho yelled. It was indeed Padme Amidala kneeling beside the dying woman, her decoy. "Come! The danger has not passed!" But Padme waved the captain back furiously, then bent low to her fallen friend. "Corday," she said quietly, her voice breaking. Corday was one of her beloved bodyguards, a woman who had been with her and serving Naboo for many years. Padme gathered Corday up in her arms, hugging her gently. Corday opened her eyes, rich brown orbs so similar to Padme's own.
"I'm sorry, m'lady,"
she gasped, struggling for breath with every word.
"I'm not sure I..."
She paused and lay there, staring at Padme.
"I failed you." "No,"
Padme insisted, arguing the bodyguard's reasoning, arguing against all of this insanity.
"No, no, no."
Corday continued to stare at her, or stare past her, it seemed, to the grief-stricken young senator. Looking past her and past everything, Corday's eyes stared into a far different place. Padme felt her relax suddenly, as if her spirit simply leapt from her corporeal form.
"Corday!"
the senator cried, and she hugged her friend close, rocking back and forth, denying this awful reality. "M'lady, you are still in danger," Typho declared, trying to sound sympathetic, but with a clear sense of urgency in his voice. Padme lifted her head from the side of Corday's face and took a deep and steadying breath. Looking upon her dead friend, remembering all at once the many times they had spent together, she gently lowered Corday to the ground.
"I shouldn't have come back,"
she said as she stood up beside the wary Typho, tears streaking her cheeks. Captain Typho came up out of his ready stance long enough to lock stares with his senator. "This vote is very important," he reminded her, his tone uncompromising, the voice of a man sworn to duty above all else, so much like his uncle. "You did your duty, Senator, and Corday did hers. Now come." He started away, grabbing Padme's arm, but she shrugged off his grasp and stood there, staring down at her lost friend. "Senator Amidala, please!" Padme looked over at the man. "Would you so diminish Corday's death as to stand here and risk your own life?" Typho bluntly stated. "What good will her sacrifice be if..."
"Enough, Captain," Padme interrupted.
Typho motioned for Dolphy to run a defensive perimeter behind them. Then he led the stricken Padme away.
Back over at Padme's Naboo fighter, R2-D2 beeped and squealed and fell into line behind them. Chapter 5. The Senate building on Coruscant wasn't one of the tallest buildings in the city. Dome-shaped and relatively low, it did not soar up to the clouds, catching the afternoon sun as the others did in a brilliant display of shining amber. And yet the magnificent structure was not dwarfed by those towering skyscrapers about it, including the various Senate apartment complexes. Centrally located in the complex and with a design very different from the typical squared skyscraper, the bluish-smooth dome provided a welcome relief to the eye of the beholder. A piece of art within a community of simple efficiency. The interior of the building was no less vast and impressive. Its gigantic rotunda encircled, row upon row, by the floating platforms of the many senators of the Republic, representing the great majority of the galaxy's inhabitable worlds. A significant number of those platforms stood empty now, because of the separatist movement. Several thousand systems had joined in with Count Dooku over the last couple of years to secede from a republic that had, in their eyes, grown too ponderous to be effective. A claim that even the staunchest supporters of the republic could not completely dispute. Still, with this most important vote scheduled, the walls of the circular room echoed, hundreds and hundreds of voices chattering all at once, expressing emotions from anger to regret to determination. In the middle of the main floor, standing at the stationary dais, the one unmoving speaking platform in the entire building, Supreme Chancellor Palpatine watched and listened, taking in the tumult and wearing an expression that showed deep concern. He was past middle age now, with silver hair and a face creased by deep lines of experience. His term limit had ended several years ago, but a series of crises had allowed him to stay in office well beyond the legal limit. From a distance, one might have thought him frail, but up close, there could be no doubt of the strength and fortitude of this accomplished man.
"They are afraid, Supreme Chancellor," Palpatine's aide, Uv Gizzen, remarked to him. "Many have heard reports of the demonstrations. Even violent activity near this very building. The Separatists!"
Palpatine held up his hand to quiet the nervous aide. "They are a troublesome group," he replied. "It would seem that Count Dooku has whipped them into murderous frenzy. Or perhaps," he said with apparent reflection, "their frustrations are mounting despite the effort of that estimable former Jedi to calm them. Either way, the Separatists must be taken seriously." Uv Gizzen started to respond again, but Palpatine put a finger to pursed lips to silence him, then nodded to the main podium, where his major domo, Masamita, was calling for order.
"Order! We shall have order!"
the major domo cried, his bluish skin brightening with agitation. His lead-horn head tentacles protruding from the backside of his skull and wrapping down over his collar to frame his head like a cowl, twitched anxiously, their brownish-tipped horns bobbing on his chest. And as he turned side to side, his primary horns, standing straight for almost half a meter above his head, rotated like antennae gathering information on the crowd. Mas Amida was an imposing figure in the Senate, but the chatter, the thousand private conversations continued.
"Senators, please," Mas Amida called loudly. "Indeed, we have much to discuss. Many important issues. But the motion before us at this time, to commission an army to protect the Republic, takes precedence. That is what we will vote on at this time, and that alone. Other business must defer."
A few complaints came back at Mas Amida, and a few conversations seemed to gather momentum. But then Supreme Chancellor Palpatine stepped up to the podium, staring out over the gathering, and the great hall went silent. Mas Amida bowed in deference to the great man and stepped aside. Palpatine placed his hands on the rim of the podium, his shoulders noticeably sagging, his head bowed. The curious posture only heightened the tension,
making the cavernous room seem even more silent, if that was possible.
My esteemed colleagues,
he began slowly and deliberately. But even with that effort, his voice wavered and seemed as if it would break apart. Curiosity sent murmurs rumbling throughout the nervous gathering once more. It wasn't often that Supreme Chancellor Palpatine appeared rattled.
Excuse me,
Palpatine said quietly. Then a moment later, he straightened and inhaled deeply, seeming to gather inner strength, which was amply reflected in his solid voice as he repeated,
My esteemed colleagues, I have just received some tragic and disturbing news. Senator Amidala of the Naboo system has been assassinated.
A shock wave of silence rolled about the crowd. Eyes went wide. Mouths, for those who had mouths, hung open in disbelief.
This grievous blow is especially personal to me,
Palpatine explained.
Before I became Chancellor, I was a senator, serving Amidala when she was Queen of Naboo. She was a great leader who fought for justice. So beloved was she among her people that she could have been elected queen for life.
He gave a great sigh and a helpless chuckle, as if that notion had been received as purely preposterous by the idealistic Amidala, as indeed it had.
But Senator Amidala believed in term limits, and she fervently believed in democracy. Her death is a great loss to us all. We will all mourn her as a relentless champion of freedom.
The Supreme Chancellor tilted his head, his eyes lowering, and he sighed again.
And as a dear friend.
A few conversations began, but for the most part, the reverential silence held strong, with many senators nodding their heads in agreement with Palpatine's eulogy. But at that critical time, on this most important day, the grim news could not overwhelm. Palpatine watched, without surprise, as the volatile senator of Malastare, Ask-Ak, maneuvered his floating platform down from the ranks and into the center of the arena. His large head rotated slowly about, his three eyes, protruding on finger-like stalks, seeming to work independently, his horizontal ears twitching.
How many more senators will die before this civil strife ends?
The Malastarian cried.
We must confront these rebels now, and we need an army to do it.
That bold statement, of course, brought many shouts of assent and dissent from the huge gathering, and several platforms moved all at once. One, bearing a blue-haired, scrunch-faced being, swept down fast beside the platform of Ask-Ak.
Why weren't the Jedi able to stop this assassination?
Demanded Darsana, the ambassador of Glianselm.
How obvious it is that we are no longer safe under the protection of the Jedi.
Another platform floated in fast on the heels of Darsana's.
The Republic needs more security now,
agreed Twi'lek Senator Ornfree Tah, his thick jowls and long blue Leku head tentacles shaking.
Now, before it comes to war.
Must I remind the senator from Malastare that negotiations are continuing with the separatists?
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine interjected.
Peace is our objective here, not war.
You say this while your friend lies dead, assassinated by those same people with whom you wish to negotiate.
Ask-Ak asked, his orange-skinned face a mask of incredulity. All around the central arena, shouts and cries erupted, with senators arguing vehemently. Many fists and other, more exotic appendages were waved in the air at that explosive point. Palpatine, supremely calm through it all, kept his disarming stare over Ask-Ak.
Did you not just name Amidala as your friend?
Ask-Ak screamed at him. Palpatine simply continued to stare at the man, a center of calm, the eye of the storm that was raging all about him.
Palpatine's majordomo rushed to the podium then, taking the cue that his master must remain above this petulant squabbling if he was to be the voice of reason throughout this ferocious debate.
Order!
Masa Mita cried repeatedly.
Senators, please!
But it went on and on, the screaming, the shouting, the fist-waving. Unnoticed through it all, yet another platform, bearing four people, approached the Senate gallery from the side, moving slowly but deliberately. Aboard the approaching platform, Senator Padme Amidala was shaking her head with disgust at the shouting and lack of civility emanating from the huge gallery before them. This is exactly why Count Dooku was able to convince so many systems to secede, she commented to her handmaiden, Dorme, who was standing beside her, with Captain Typho and Jar Jar Binks in front of them, the captain driving the platform. There are many who believe that the Republic has become too large and disjointed, Dorme agreed. They came into the gallery, then moved slowly onto the main central area. But the senators there, and those in the lower rows of the gallery, were too involved with their shouting and arguing to even notice the unexpected appearance. Standing at the podium, though, Palpatine did see Amidala. His expression was one of blatant shock for just a moment, but then he shook himself out of it and a smile widened upon his face.
My noble colleagues,
Amidala said loudly, and the sound of her most familiar voice quieted many of the senators, who turned to regard her.
I concur with the Supreme Chancellor. At all costs, we do not want war.
Gradually at first, but then more quickly, the Senate Hall went quiet. And then came a thunderous outburst of cheering and applause.
It is with great surprise and joy that the chair recognizes the Senator from Naboo, Padme Amidala,
Palpatine declared. Amidala waited for the cheering and clapping to subside, then began slowly and deliberately.
Less than an hour ago, an assassination attempt was made upon my life. One of my bodyguards and six others were ruthlessly and senselessly murdered. I was the target, but more importantly, I believe this security measure before you was the target. I have led the opposition to building an army, but there is someone who will stop at nothing to assure its passage.
Cheers became boos from many areas of the gallery as those surprising words registered, and many others shook their heads in confusion. Had Amidala just accused someone in the Senate of trying to assassinate her? As she stood there, her gaze moving about the vast circular room, Amidala knew that her words, on the surface, could be seen as an insult to many. In truth, though, she wasn't thinking along those lines concerning the source of the assassination. She had a definite hunch, one that went against the obvious logic. The people who would most logically want her silenced were indeed those in favor of the formation of an army of the Republic. But for some reason she could not put her finger on, some subconscious clues, perhaps, or just a gut feeling, Amidala believed that the source of the attempt was exactly those who would not logically, on the surface at least, want her silenced. She remembered Panaka's warning about the Trade Federation reportedly joining hands with the separatists. She took a deep breath, steeling herself against the growing rancor in the audience, and steadfastly went on.
I warn you, if you vote to create this army, war will follow. I have experienced the misery of war firsthand. I do not wish to do so again.
The cheering began to outweigh the booing.
This is insanity, I say!
Ornfree Ta yelled above it all.
I move that we defer this vote immediately!
But that suggestion only led to more yelling. Amidala looked at the Twi'lek Senator, understanding his sudden desire to defer a vote that her mere presence had cast into doubt.
Wake up, Senators! You must wake up! She went on, shouting him down. If we offer the Separatists violence, they can only show us violence in return. Many will lose their lives, and all will lose their freedom. This decision could well destroy the very foundation of our great republic. I pray you do not let fear push you into a disastrous decision. Vote down this security measure, which is nothing less than a declaration of war. Does anyone here want that? I cannot believe they do.
Ask Ak, Ornfried Ta, and Darsana, on their floating platforms down by the podium, exchanged nervous glances as the cheers and boos echoed about the great hall. The fact that Amidala had just survived an assassination attempt and yet was here begging the Senate to put off raising an army against the likely perpetrators only added strength to her argument, only elevated Amidala higher in the eyes of many. And the former Queen of Naboo, having stood firm against the Trade Federation a decade before, was already held in high esteem by many. At Ask-Ak's nod, Ornfried Ta demanded the floor and was given it promptly by Palpatine.
By precedence of order, my motion to defer the vote must be dealt with first,
Ornfried Ta demanded.
That is the rule of law.
Amidala glared at the Twi'lek, her expression both angry and frustrated by the obvious delaying tactic. She turned plaintively to Palpatine. But the Supreme Chancellor, though his responding expression seemed to be sympathetic to her plight, could only shrug. He moved to the podium and held up his hands for order, and when the room was quiet enough, announced,
"In view of the lateness of the hour and the seriousness of this motion, we will take up these matters tomorrow. Until then, the Senate stands adjourned."
Traffic clogged the Coruscant sky, flowing slowly about the meandering smoggy haze. The sun was up, giving the sprawling city an amber glow, but many lights were still on, shining behind the windows of the great skyscrapers. The massive towers of the Republic Executive Building loomed above it all, seeming as if they would reach the very heavens. And that seemed fitting indeed, for inside, even at this early hour, the events and participants took on godlike stature to the trillions of common folk of the Republic. Supreme Chancellor Palpatine sat behind his desk in his spacious and tasteful office, staring across at his four Jedi Master visitors. Across the room, a pair of red-clad guards flanked the door, imposing powerful figures with their great curving helmets and wide floor-length capes.
"I fear this vote," Palpatine remarked.
"It is unavoidable," replied Mace Windu.
A tall and muscular human, bald and with penetrating eyes, standing next to the even taller Ki-Adi Mundi.
"And it could unravel the remainder of the Republic," Palpatine said. "Never have I seen the senators so at odds over any issue."
"Few issues would carry the import of creating a Republic army,"
Jedi Master Plo Koon remarked. He was a tall, sturdy Keldor, his head ridged and ruffled at the sides, like the curly hair of a young girl, and with dark shadowed eyes and a black mask over the lower portion of his face.
"The senators are anxious and afraid, and believe that no vote will ever be more important than this one now before them."
"And this way or that, much mending must you do,"
said Master Yoda, the smallest in physical stature, but a Jedi Master who stood tall against anyone in the galaxy. Yoda's huge eyes blinked slowly, and his tremendous ears swiveled subtly, showing for those who knew him that he was deep in thought, giving the situation his utmost attention.
"Unseen is much that is here,"
he said, and he closed his eyes in contemplation.
"I don't know how much longer I can hold off the vote, my friends,"
Palpatine explained.
"And I fear that delay on this definitive issue might well erode the Republic through attrition. More and more star systems are joining the Separatists."
Mace Windu, a pillar of strength even among the Jedi, nodded his understanding of the dilemma.
"And yet, when the vote is done, if the losers do break away..."
"I will not let this Republic that has stood for 1,000 years be split in two,"
Palpatine declared, slamming a fist determinedly on his desk.
"My negotiations will not fail."
Mace Windu held his calm, keeping his rich voice even and controlled.
But if they do, you must realize there aren't enough Jedi to protect the Republic. We are keepers of the peace, not soldiers.
Palpatine took a few steadying breaths, trying to digest it all. Master Yoda, he said, and he waited for the greenish-skinned Jedi to regard him.
Do you really think it will come to war?
Again Yoda closed his eyes.
Worse than war, I fear, he said. Much worse.
What? An alarmed Palpatine asked.
Master Yoda, what do you sense? Mace Windu prompted.
Impossible to see. The future is,
the small Jedi Master replied, his great orb still looking inward.
The dark side, clouds, everything. But this I am sure of.
He popped open his eyes and stared hard at Palpatine.
Do their duty. The Jedi will.
A brief look of confusion came over the Supreme Chancellor. But before he could begin to respond to Yoda, a hologram appeared on his desk. The image of Dar Wak, one of his aides.
The Loyalist Committee has arrived, my lord, said Dar Wak in Huttese.
Send them in. The hologram disappeared and Palpatine rose, along with the seated Jedi, to properly greet the distinguished visitors. They came in two groups. Senator Padme Amidala, walking with Captain Typho, Jar Jar Binks, her handmaiden Dorme, and Major Domo Mas Amida, followed by two other senators, Bail Organa of Alderaan and Horrocks Rider. Everyone moved to exchange pleasant greetings, and Yoda pointedly tapped Padme with his small cane.
With you, the Force is strong, young senator,
the Jedi Master told her.
Your tragedy on the landing platform, terrible. To see you alive brings warm feelings to my heart.
Thank you, Master Yoda, she replied. Do you have any idea who was behind this attack? Her question had everyone in the room turning to regard her and Yoda directly. Mace Windu cleared his throat and stepped forward.
Senator, we have nothing definitive, but our intelligence points to disgruntled spice miners on the moons of Naboo.
Padme looked to Captain Typho, who shook his head, having no answers.
They had both witnessed the frustration of those spice miners back on Naboo, but those demonstrations seemed a long way from the tragedy that had occurred on the landing platform here on Coruscant.
Releasing Typho from her gaze, she stared hard at Mace Windu, wondering if it would be wise to voice her hunch at this time. She knew the controversy she might stir, knew the blatant illogical ring to her claim, but still.
I do not wish to disagree, she said, but I think that Count Dooku was behind it.
A stir of surprise rippled about the room, and the four Jedi Masters exchanged looks that ranged from astonishment to disapproval.
You know, m'lady, Mace said in his resonant and calm voice. Count Dooku was once a Jedi. He wouldn't assassinate anyone. It's not in his character.
He is a political idealist, Ki-Adi Mundi, the fourth of the Jedi contingent, added. Not a murderer.
With his great domed head, the Saurian Jedi Master stood taller than anyone in the room, and the ridged flaps at the side of his pensive face added a measure of introspection to his imposing physical form. Master Yoda tapped his cane, drawing attention to himself, and that alone exerted a calming influence over the increasingly tense mood.
In dark times, nothing is what it appears to be,
the diminutive figure remarked.
But the fact remains, Senator. In grave danger you are.
Supreme Chancellor Palpatine gave a dramatic sigh and walked over to the window, staring out at the Coruscant dawn.
Master Jedi, he said, may I suggest that the Senator be placed under the protection of your graces?
Do you think that a wise use of our limited resources at this stressful time?
Senator Bail Organa was quick to interject, stroking his well-trimmed black goatee.
Thousands of systems have gone over fully to the Separatists, and many more may soon join them. The Jedi are our...
Chancellor, Padme interrupted.
If I may comment, I do not believe the...
Situation is that serious, Palpatine finished for her.
No, but I do, Senator.
Chancellor, please, she pleaded. I do not want any more guards.
Palpatine stared at her, as would an overprotective father, a look that Padme might have viewed as condescending from any other man.
I realize all too well that additional security might be disruptive for you, he began.
And he paused, and then a look came over him, as if he had just struck upon a logical and acceptable compromise.
But perhaps someone you are familiar with. An old friend.
Smiling cleverly, Palpatine looked to Mace Windu and Yoda.
Master Kenobi?
He finished with a nod, and his smile only widened when Mace Windu nodded back.
That's possible, the Jedi confirmed. He has just returned from a border dispute on Ancien.
You must remember him, m'lady,
Palpatine said, grinning as if it was a done deal.
He watched over you during the blockade conflict.
This is not necessary, Chancellor, Padme said determinedly. But Palpatine didn't relinquish his grin in the least, showing clearly that he knew well how to defeat the independent senator's argument.
Do it for me, m'lady. Please. I will rest easier. We had a big scare today. The thought of losing you is unbearable.
Several times Amidala started to respond, but how could she possibly say anything to deny the Supreme Chancellor's expressed concern? She gave a great defeated sigh, and the Jedi rose and turned to leave.
I will have Obi-Wan report to you immediately, m'lady, Mace Windu informed her.
As he passed, Yoda leaned in close to Padme and whispered so that only she could hear.
Too little about yourself, you worry, Senator, and too much about politics. Be mindful of your danger, Padme. Accept our help.
They all left the room, and Padme Amidala stared at the door and the flanking guards for a long while. Behind her, at the back of his office, Chancellor Palpatine watched them all.
It troubles me to hear Count Dooku's name mentioned in such a manner, Master,
Mace said to Yoda as the Jedi made their way back to their council chamber.
And from one as esteemed as Senator Amidala. Any mistrust of Jedi, or even former Jedi, in times such as these can be disastrous.
Deny Dooku's involvement in the Separatist movement we cannot,
Yoda reminded him.
Nor can we deny that he began in that movement because of ideals, Mace argued. He was once our friend. That we must not forget. And to hear him slandered and named as an assassin.
Not named,
Yoda said.
But darkness there is, about us all. And in that darkness, nothing is what it seems.
But it makes little sense to me that Count Dooku would make an attempt on the life of Senator Amidala when she is the one most adamantly opposed to the creation of an army. Would not the Separatists wish Amidala well in her endeavors? Would they not believe that she is, however unintentionally, an ally to their cause? Or are we really to believe that they want war with the Republic?
Yoda leaned heavily on his cane, seeming very weary, and his huge eyes slowly closed.
More is here than we can know,
he said very quietly.
Clouded is the Force. Troubling it is.
Mace dismissed his forthcoming reflexive response, a further defense of his old friend Dooku. Count Dooku had been among the most accomplished of the Jedi Masters, respected among the Council, a student of the older and, some would say, more profound Jedi philosophies and styles, including an arcane lightsaber fighting style that was more front and back, thrust and riposte, than the typical circular movements currently employed by most of the Jedi. What a blow it had been to the Jedi Order and to Mace Windu when Dooku had walked away from them, and for many of the same reasons the Separatists were now trying to walk away. The perception that the Republic had grown too ponderous and unresponsive to the needs of the individual, even of individual systems. It was no less troubling to Mace Windu concerning Dooku, as it was, no doubt, to Amidala and Palpatine concerning the Separatists, that some of the arguments against the Republic were not without merit. Chapter 6. As the lights of Coruscant dimmed, gradually replaced by the natural lights of the few twinkling stars that could get through the nearly continual glare, the great and towering city took on a vastly different appearance. Under the dark evening sky, the skyscrapers seemed to become gigantic natural monoliths, and all the supersized structures that so dominated the city, that so marked Coruscant as a monument to the ingenuity of the reasoning species, seemed somehow the mark of folly, of futile pride striving against the vastness and majesty beyond the grasp of any mortal. Even the wind at the higher levels of the structures sounded mournful, almost as a herald to what would eventually, inevitably, become of the great city and the great civilization. As Obi-Wan Kenobi and Anakin Skywalker stood in the turbo lift of the Senate Department Complex, the Jedi Master was indeed pondering such profound universal truths as the subtle change of day to night. Beside him, though, his young Padawan certainly was not. Anakin was about to see Padme again, the woman who had captured his heart and soul when he was but 9 years old and had never let it go. "You seem a little on edge, Anakin," Obi-Wan noted as the lift continued its climb. "Not at all," came the unconvincing reply. "I haven't seen you this nervous since we fell into that nest of Gundogs." "You fell into that nightmare, Master, and I rescued you, remember?" Obi-Wan's little distraction seemed to have the desired effect, and the pair shared a much-needed laugh. Coming out of it, though, Anakin remained obviously on edge. "You're sweating," Obi-Wan noted. "Take a deep breath. Relax. I haven't seen her in 10 years. "Anakin, relax," Obi-Wan reiterated. "She's not the queen anymore." The lift door slid open, and Obi-Wan started away, while Anakin, behind him, muttered under his breath, "That's not why I'm nervous." As the pair stepped into the corridor, a door across the way slid open, and a well-dressed Gungan, wearing fine red and black robes, stepped into the corridor opposite them. The three regarded each other for just a moment, and then the Gungan diplomat, losing all sense of reserve and propriety, began hopping around like a child.
"Obi! Obi! Obi!"
Jar Jar Binks cried, tongue and ears flapping.
"Misa so smiling to seeing you, sir! Woohoo!"
Obi-Wan smiled politely, though his glance at Anakin did show that he was a bit embarrassed, and he patted his hands gently in the air, trying to calm the excitable fellow.
"It's good to see you too, Jar Jar."
Jar Jar continued to hop around for just a moment, then suddenly, and with obvious great effort, calmed down.
"And this, Misa guessing, is a youth apprentice?"
he went on, and the Gungan seemed to have much more control of himself. For a moment, at least, until he took a good look at the young Padawan, and all pretense melted away.
"No!"
he shrieked, clapping his hands together.
"Annie? No! Little bitty Annie?"
Jar Jar grabbed the Padawan and pulled him forcefully to arm's length, studying him head to toe.
"No! You're so biggin'! Yay! Annie! Misa no believe him."
Now it was Anakin's turn to wear the embarrassed smile. Politely, he offered no resistance as the overexcited Gungan slammed him into a crushing hug, childish hop shaking him violently. "Hi, Jar Jar," Anakin managed to say. And Jar Jar just continued on, hopping and crying out his name and issuing a series of strange yai-yai sounds. It seemed as if it would go on forever. But then Obi-Wan gently but firmly grabbed Jar Jar by the arm.
"We have come to speak with Senator Amidala. Could you show us to her?"
Jar Jar stopped bouncing and looked at Obi-Wan intently, his duck-billed face taking on a more serious expression.
She's expecting you, sir. Annie, Misa no believin'.
His head bobbed a bit more, then he grabbed Anakin by the hand and pulled him along. The apartment inside was tastefully decorated, with cushiony chairs and a divan set in a circular pattern in the center, and a few well-placed artworks set about the walls. Dorme and Typho were in the room, standing beside the divan. The captain wearing his typical military garb, blue uniform under a brown leather tunic with black leather gloves and a stiff cap, its brim and band of black leather. Beside him stood Dorme in one of the elegant yet understated dresses typical of Padme's handmaidens. Anakin, though, didn't see either of them. He focused on the third person in the room, Padme, and on her alone. And if he had ever held any moments of doubt that she was as beautiful as he remembered her, they were washed away, then and there. His eyes roamed the senator's small and shapely frame in her black and deep purple robes, taking in every detail. He saw her thick brown hair drawn up high and far at the back of her head in a basket-like accessory, and wanted to lose himself in it. He saw her eyes and wanted to stare into them for eternity. He saw her lips and wanted to. Anakin closed his eyes for just a moment and inhaled deeply. And he could smell her again, the scent that had been burned into him as Padme's. It took every ounce of willpower he could muster to walk in slowly and respectfully behind Obi-Wan, and not merely rush in and crush Padme in a hug. And yet, paradoxically, it took every bit of his willpower to move his legs, which were suddenly seeming so very weak, and take that first step into the room, that first step toward her.
Misa here. Looky, looky!
Screeched Jar Jar, hardly the announcement Obi-Wan would have preferred, but one that he knew he had to expect from the emotionally volatile Gungan.
Disa Jedi arriving!
It's a pleasure to see you again, m'lady, Obi-Wan said, moving to stand before the beautiful young senator. Standing behind his master, Anakin continued to stare at the woman, to note her every move. She did glance at him once, though very briefly, and he detected no recognition in her eyes. Padme took Obi-Wan's hand in her own. It has been far too long, Master Kenobi. I'm so glad our paths have crossed again. But I must warn you that I think your presence here is unnecessary. I'm sure that the members of the Jedi Council have their reasons, Obi-Wan replied. Padme wore a resigned, accepting expression at that answer. But a look of curiosity replaced it as she glanced again behind the Jedi Knight, to the young Padawan standing patiently. She took a step to the side so that she was directly in front of Anakin. Annie? She asked, her expression purely incredulous. Her smile and the flash in her eyes showed that she needed no answer. For just a flicker, Anakin felt her spirit leap. Annie, Padme said again. Can it be? My goodness, how you've grown! She looked down and then followed the line of his lean body, tilting her head back to emphasize his height, and he realized that he now towered over her. That did little to bolster Anakin's confidence, though. So lost was he in the beauty of Padme. Her smile widened, a clear sign that she was glad to see him, but he missed it. Or the implications of it, at least. So have you, he answered awkwardly, as if he had to force each word from his mouth. Grown more beautiful, I mean. He cleared his throat and stood taller. And much shorter, he teased, trying unsuccessfully to sound in control. For a senator, I mean. Anakin noted Obi-Wan's disapproving scowl, but Padme laughed any tension away and shook her head. Oh, Annie, you'll always be that little boy I knew on Tatooine, she said. And if she had taken the lightsaber from his belt and sliced his legs out from under him, she would not have shortened Anakin Skywalker any more. He looked down, his embarrassment only heightened by the looks he knew that both Obi-Wan and Captain Typho were throwing his way. Our presence will be invisible, m'lady, he heard Obi-Wan assure Padme. I'm very grateful that you're here, Master Kenobi. Captain Typho put in, The situation is more dangerous than the senator will admit. I don't need any more security, Padme said, addressing Typho initially, but turning to regard Obi-Wan as she continued. I need answers. I want to know who is trying to kill me. I believe that there might lie an issue of the utmost importance to the Senate. There is something more here. She stopped as a frown crossed Obi-Wan Kenobi's face. We're here to protect you, Senator, not to start an investigation, he said in calm and deliberate tones. But even as he finished, Anakin contradicted him. We'll find out who's trying to kill you, Padme, the Padawan insisted. I promise you. As soon as he finished, Anakin recognized his error, one that clearly showed on the scowl that Obi-Wan flashed his way. He had been fashioning a response to Padme in his thoughts, and had hardly even registered his master's explanation before he had blurted out the obviously errant words. Now he can only bite his lip and lower his gaze. We are not going to exceed our mandate, my young Padawan learner, Obi-Wan said sharply. And Anakin was stung to be so dressed down publicly, especially in front of this particular audience. I meant in the interest of protecting her, Master, of course. His justification sounded inane, even to Anakin. We are not going through this exercise again, Anakin, Obi-Wan continued. You will pay attention to my lead. Anakin could hardly believe that Obi-Wan was continuing to do this in front of Padme. Why? He asked, turning the question and the debate, trying desperately to regain some footing and credibility. What? Obi-Wan exclaimed, as taken aback as Anakin had ever seen him, and the young Padawan knew that he was pushing too far and too fast. Why else do you think we were assigned to her if not to find the killer? He asked, trying to bring a measure of calm back to the situation. Protection is a job for local security, not for Jedi. It's overkill, Master. And so an investigation is implied in our mandate. We will do as the Council has instructed, Obi-Wan countered. And you will learn your place, young one. Perhaps with merely your presence about me, the mystery surrounding this threat will be revealed, offered Padme, ever the diplomat. She smiled alternately at Anakin and at Obi-Wan, an invitation for civility, and when both leaned back, shoulders visibly relaxing, she added, Now, if you will excuse me, I will retire. They all bowed as Padme and Dorme exited the room, and then Obi-Wan stared hard at his young Padawan again, neither seeming overly pleased with the other. Well, I know that I'm glad to have you here, Captain Typho offered, moving closer to the pair. I don't know what's going on here, but the Senator can't have too much security right now. Your friends in the Jedi Council seem to think that minors have something to do with this, but I can't really agree with that. What have you learned? Anakin asked. Obi-Wan threw him a look of warning. We'll be better prepared to protect the Senator if we have some idea of what we're up against, Anakin explained to his master. Logic he knew that Obi-Wan had to accept as reasonable. Not much, Typho admitted. Senator Amidala leads the opposition to the creation of a Republic Army. She's very determined to deal with the Separatists through negotiation and not force. But the attempts on her life, even though they've failed, have only strengthened the opposition to her viewpoint in the Senate. And since the Separatists would not logically wish to see a Republic Army formed, Obi-Wan reasoned, we're left without a clue, Typho said. In any such incident, the first questioning eyes turned toward Count Dooku and the Separatists. A frown crossed Obi-Wan's face, and Typho quickly added, or to some of those loyal to his movement, at least. But why they'd go after Senator Amidala is anyone's guess. And we are not here to guess, but merely to protect, Obi-Wan said, in tones that showed he was finished with this particular line of discussion. Typho bowed, hearing him clearly. I'll have an officer on every floor, and I'll be at the command center downstairs. Typho left then, and Obi-Wan began a search of the room and adjoining chambers, trying to get a feel for the place. Anakin started to do likewise, but he stopped when he walked by Jar Jar Binks.
Misa bustin' with happiness seeing you again, Annie.
She didn't even recognize me, Anakin said, staring at the door through which Padme had departed. He shook his head despondently and turned to the Gungan. I've thought about her every day since we parted, and she's forgotten me completely.
Why are you saying that?
Jar Jar asked. You saw her, Anakin replied.
She's a happy,
the Gungan assured him.
Happier than Misa seeing her in a long old time. These are bad times, Annie. Bomb bad times.
Anakin shook his head and started to repeat his distress, but he noted Obi-Wan moving toward him and wisely held his tongue. Except that his observant master had already discerned the conversation.
You're focusing on the negative again, he said to Anakin. Be mindful of your thoughts. She was pleased to see us. Leave it at that. Now let's check the security here. We have much to do.
Anakin bowed. Yes, master. He could say the compliant words because he had to, but the young Padawan could not dismiss that which was in his heart and in his thoughts. Padme sat at her vanity, brushing her thick brown hair, staring into the mirror but not really seeing anything there. Her thoughts were replaying again and again the image of Anakin, the look he had given her. She heard his words again, grown more beautiful. And though Padme was undeniably that, those were not words she was used to hearing. Since she had been a young girl, Padme had been involved in politics, quickly rising to powerful and influential positions. Most of the men she had come into contact with had been more concerned with what she could bring to them in practical terms than with her beauty, or, for that matter, with any true personal feelings for her. As Queen of Naboo, and now a senator, Padme was well aware that she was attractive to men in ways deeper than physical attraction, in ways deeper than any emotional bond. Or perhaps not deeper than the latter, she told herself. For she could not deny the intensity in Anakin's eyes as he had looked at her. But what did it mean? She saw him again in her thoughts, and clearly. Her mental eye roamed over his lean and strong frame, over his face, tight with that intensity that she had always admired, and yet with eyes sparkling with joy, with mischief, with longing. That thought stopped the senator. Her hand slipped down to her sides, and she sat there, staring at herself, judging her own appearance as Anakin might. After a few long moments, Padme shook her head, telling herself that it was crazy. Anakin was a Jedi now. That was their dedication and their oath, and those things above all else were things Padme Amidala admired. How could he even look at her in such a manner? So it was all her imagination. Or was it her fantasy? Laughing at herself, Padme lifted her brush to her hair again, but she paused before she had even begun. She was wearing a silky white nightgown, and there were, after all, security cams in her room. Those cams had never really bothered her since she had always looked at them clinically. Security cams, with guards watching her every move, were a fact of her existence. And so she had learned to go about her daily routines, even the private ones, without a second thought to the intrusive eyes. But now she realized that a certain young Jedi might be on the other end of those lenses. Chapter 7. Clad in gray armor that was somewhat outdated, burned from countless blaster shots, but still undeniably effective, the bounty hunter stood easily on the ledge, 100 stories and more up from the Coruscant street. His helmet, too, was gray, except for a blue ridge crossing his eyes and running down from brow to chin. His perch seemed somewhat precarious, considering the wind at this height. But to one as agile and skilled as Django, and with a penchant for getting himself into and out of difficult places, this was nothing out of the ordinary. Right on time, a speeder pulled up near the ledge and hovered there. Django's associate, Zam Wessel, nodded to him and climbed out, stepping lithely onto the ledge in front of a couple of bright advertisement windows. She wore a red veil over the bottom half of her face,